It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Experimental drugs to fight the Ebola virus arrive in Liberia as the death toll mounts. Libya's parliament demands the militia disarm. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Experimental drugs used to fight the Ebola outbreak arrived Wednesday in Liberia as the effects of the deadly virus continue to spread, leaving 1,069 dead, nearly 2,000 confirmed cases. That according to the World Health Organization. In just 2 days, August 10 and 11, there were 120 new cases and 56 fatalities. The U.S.-produced drug, not yet tested in humans, will be used to treat two doctors in Liberia. Health Ministry official Tobert Nianswa witnessed the offloading of the drug ZMAP brought from the U.S. by Liberia's foreign minister.
You can see them. They are in, sealed in their boxes. The cold chain, temperature control. Is maintained. We've already at the ERW hospital put in freezers that will maintain the cold chain of these medications so that they are administered to critical staff. It's trial and it is at the risk of the patients. Mm-hmm. Not the government of Liberia, not the Ministry of Health and Social Welfare, or the pharmaceutical company will be held liable for anything that happens because you know this is a trial medication that have not been gone through the efficacy of level 3 clinical trials.
Healthcare workers across Africa have been among the hardest hit group in the fight against Ebola. Sierra Leone Wednesday announced the death of Dr. Modupa Cole, a senior physician in Freetown. In Guinea Wednesday, President Alpha Conde declared a health emergency, announcing measures that include strict border controls and travel restrictions. Three West African countries, Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, have been the hardest hit, although Nigeria Wednesday reported its third fatality. The number of cases in Nigeria officially dropped to 12. Onyembuchi Chukwu is the country's health minister.
Presently, in Lagos, 177 persons who are both primary and secondary contacts are under surveillance. Now, with the end of the 21-day maximum incubation period, those who are primary contacts who have not developed the disease will no longer continue to be on surveillance.
He spoke in Abuja after President Goodluck Jonathan met with the country's state governors and health commissioners on the outbreak. Kenya remains a high-risk location, although no cases of Ebola have been reported there. Mohamed Yusuf has the story in Nairobi.
The WHO representative in Kenya, Dr. Custodia Mandelat, said her organization has classified Kenya as a level 2 risk infection area.
Our quick risk analysis shows that Kenya is high risk of transmission. Therefore, our preparedness to avert the importation of the quickly contained circulation of the virus.
Kenyan media report some travelers have raised concerns over poor screening of people at the country's entry points, especially at the airport. Kenya's Health Secretary James Macharia says the government is moving to combat the disease.
The ministry has constituted a multi-agency Ebola task force, which has been meeting for 3 months now to assess the situation at local, country, regional, and global levels, and advise the ministry on response activities.
So far, the country remains Ebola-free, although worry that the virus will find its way into the country is running high. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Germany Wednesday urged its citizens to leave Sierra Leone, Guinea and Liberia due to the Ebola outbreak. And representatives of Gulf monarchies met in Riyadh Wednesday, discussing Ebola precautions ahead of the annual Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca in early October. Libya's parliament Wednesday voted to disband armed militia and called on the UN for an international intervention to bid a quell in violence that has gripped the nation for the most of 3 years since dictator Muammar Gaddafi was toppled in 2011. In recent days, militia have been fighting for control of the airport in Libya's largest city, Tripoli, and the second largest, Benghazi, where hundreds reportedly have been killed. Thousands, including diplomatic staff, have fled the country. The French press agency reports both Spain and Italy are struggling to cope with a huge surge of African migrants, rescuing more than 2,300 from rickety boats in the past 2 days as they desperately seek a better life in Europe. Officials say calm weather has lured many to make the dangerous journey. An estimated 98,000 have been rescued at sea so far this year. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Peter Clote in Washington. Today is Thursday, August 14, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The head of Swaziland's largest trade union says it will protest government policies that got the country expelled from the African Growth and Opportunity Act, AGOA.
Our work is to continue opposing such actions by this government, because we cannot sit back and let it have its way. We cannot accept that.
That's the General Secretary of the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland, Vincent Nkongwani. A U.S. State Department official links trade and human rights.
We do ask more of our friends and partners than, say, China does. We ask for high standards of respect for rule of law and fighting corruption, protection of the environment, protection of workers. But we also ask a lot of ourselves.
That's U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights and Labor, Tom Malinowski. Aid workers welcomed the visit of the United Nations Security Council to South Sudan, and a Tunisian philanthropist gives his prescriptions for democracy in the country. Those stories, plus Marco Ume's sport and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The General Secretary of the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland, or TUKOSWA, says members will protest Minister of Labour and Social Security Winnie Makagule's appearance before Parliament today, Thursday. Vincent Nkongwani said Swaziland is set to lose about 17,000 jobs after the country was thrown out of the African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA, initiative over the country's poor human rights record. Nkongwani told me earlier that TUKOSWA will continue to oppose government policies he says will not benefit the trade union and the country.
Members are mobilizing for protest action. Of course, the challenges that they have ensured that they prepare to crush any protest, but that is what our members are mobilizing to do. It is estimated the economy that it is over 17,000 jobs, in fact. Yeah, it's just that we have heard from some parliamentarians that there's going to be a session in Parliament on AGOA, and we are mobilizing our members to turn up so that we want to hear from the minister as to exactly what is it that this government has in mind as a AGOA, beyond just misleading the international community.
What will your people do in Parliament on Thursday?
Well, we are going there to get it directly from the minister as she takes the floor. But we must say that as Labour, we wonder as to what that will be, because as part of the tripartite structure, we expected that she would also have had the courtesy to bring us on board as to what exactly is happening. We are in the dark as anybody else.
In Kogwani, we had reports that Prime Minister has formally withdrawn a statement that you and your other colleagues should be hanged for criticizing his administration while you were here in Washington. What do you make of this apology?
Yeah, he has said we should be throttled, and we must say that the retraction, in our view, can only have come about because of the pressure which he had not thought was going to come at him from both locally and outside the country.
State Department expressed concern about his statement and said that that is threatening. Do you think that contributed to his decision to redraw the apology? And has he called you officially to apologize based on that statement he made?
No, he has not called us. And we are of the view that it is pressure, such as the statement from the State Department and, of course, other organizations that made him to repent. We don't think that he would have willingly made the retraction.
Is his apology accepted to you and your colleague?
Well, for us, it's not a question of whether or not we do. It's just that we now want to get on with our work.
How do you want to get on your work when some people are saying that the political and labor-related space has been closed by the administration? How do you do that?
Our work is to continue opposing such actions by this government, because we cannot sit back and let it have its way. We cannot accept that.
What has the government been doing that you strongly oppose?
Firstly, it has dismally failed to address the benchmarks that would have ensured that we do not get thrown out of AGOA. And these are benchmarks it willingly undertook in Geneva in 2013. So they failed to do anything for all these months except misleading the nation and the international community that they are doing something.
Vincent Nkongwane is General Secretary of the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland, TUKOSWA. He spoke with me earlier from the capital, Mbabane. Aid workers and rights activists have welcomed yesterday's UN Security Council visit to South Sudan. They say they hope it will encourage the warring parties to stop wasting time and finally reach a peace agreement. Magume Davis Wakarinji has more for VOA from Juba.
Tariq Riebo, head of the UK charity Oxfam, calls for the UNSCC visit timely.
We are hoping that the Security Council visit will draw attention of the international community to this, and also that the Security Council will increase its engagement on South Sudan and put pressure on both sides to reach an agreement as soon as possible.
The deadline to reach a deal on the formation of a transitional government expired last Sunday. Abia Robin, project coordinator for the local human rights lobbying group Voice for Change, says there is only one message that both President Kiir and Machar can easily understand.
If those people are actually sanctioned, you will realize, because most of them even have their family outside there, and if their bank account is being frozen and kept, even all their assets that their income comes in, believe you me, they will begin to look to this situation that is a serious issue.
Edmond Yakani, coordinator for the local NGO, Community for Empowerment for Progress Organization, agrees.
We feel that let them be timely and let them not compromise and let them make very hard decisions that it's centered to protect the civilians in South Sudan.
Riebo wants the Security Council to compel South Sudan's government to sign and ratify the arms trade treaty, which he says will reduce the suffering of the people.
In any conflict state, the treaty is vital in ensuring that we can try and reduce the atrocities committed, because the flow of arms is the fundamental reason why conflict can happen. So if we can control the inflow of arms into the country, then overall we would be able to hopefully reduce some of the impact on the ground.
The UN says nearly 4 million South Sudanese are at risk of famine unless peace is restored quickly. Riebo says because of the ongoing fighting, humanitarian agencies are not able to deliver much-needed aid, especially in remote locations. He says people are suffering.
I think we need to really be aware of the catastrophe this country is facing on a humanitarian scale. This is already one of the worst crises in the world, if not the worst, in terms of humanitarian impact. Beyond the conflict, we are looking at food insecurity increasing systematically across the country, across many of the provinces in the country.
At least 6 aid workers were killed last week, reportedly by a local militia in Upper Nile State, Maban County, prompting many organizations to suspend their operations in the area. Joseph Contreras, acting spokesperson for the UN mission in South Sudan, says more than 200 workers were evacuated from the county after last week's incident. For VOA News, I am Mugume Desura Karinj in Juba.
Later this year, Tunisia holds elections which will be closely watched around the world. The North African country's 2011 revolution helped inspire the larger Arab uprisings. Today, many hope it will also spread the seeds for Arab democracies. One man will not be running in the polls, but what he says gets plenty of attention. From Paris, Lisa Brand has more for VOA on businessman and philanthropist Lofty Maktouf and his prescriptions for saving Tunisia.
Bonjour et bienvenue dans l'entretien de France 24. Sauver la Tunisie, c'est le cri d'alarme lancé par Lotfi Maktouf.
It's been a year since Lotfi Maktouf published Sauver la Tunisie, or Save Tunisia, but the headline-grabbing book and its author are still in the news. An international businessman based in Monaco, Maktouf seems a long way from his homeland. But his assessment of post-revolution Tunisia, what's gone wrong and what's needed for it to go right, has resonated in the North African country and abroad.
Let me put it this way. I'm optimistic for my country on the medium to long term. I'm not that clear about what's cooking these days. I don't know to what extent that technocrat government is doing anything. The curse for this transition government that it didn't do the long term, it didn't go didn't do the short term either.
Maktouf issue's focus is on his Al Madaniya Foundation, which he started shortly after Tunisia's revolution, but not before he made a reconnaissance visit to a country he left more than 35 years ago.
And I traveled there 4 days a week, consistently, for 4 months, all over the country. I visited everywhere, and especially the areas which were totally forgotten by the old regime, and tried to understand. And I listened, and I learned so much about this beautiful country and about what a Tunisian meant, being a Tunisian meant, you know.
Al Madaniya focuses on Tunisia's environment, culture, and especially on education. That was Maktouf's own ticket out of a poor home in the coastal town of Sousse. He earned law degrees at the Sorbonne in France and Harvard in the United States. He worked on Wall Street and for the International Monetary Fund before returning to Europe.
I'm a firm believer in this American dream idea, and I lived it. I come from a very poor background. I ended up at Harvard. I don't want to, you know, brag about myself. There are many other people who did even better than me. But all I'm saying is that it is possible. How is it possible? Hard work.
Along with Tunisians, Maktouf is sharing that message with immigrant kids in France's working-class suburbs, where he's invited to participate in seminars. He's also working on another book, drawing lessons about the wider Arab uprising. He believes democracy starts at the grassroots, and he hopes it will take hold in Tunisia. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
A high-ranking U.S. official says U.S. companies are more likely to invest in countries which respect the rule of law and human rights. Tom Malinowski is U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights and Labor. In a recent conversation with reporter Edward Raymer, Mr. Malinowski described the link between human rights investment and economic growth.
Yeah, I think actually the best time to talk about respect for human rights is when we're talking about business, when we're talking about security. You don't need a side conversation to talk about those issues because it's a core part of what needs to happen in any country, whether it's the United States or a country in Africa, in order to ensure security and stability and investment and growth. For example, one issue that everybody's concerned about here is corruption and illicit finance. Who's going to grow a business? Who's going to farm land if the fruits of your labor, the product of your genius, is just going to be taken by somebody because they're more powerful, or if somebody can beat you in the competition because they've paid a bribe?
What kind of advice would you give to an American company that wishes to invest in Africa?
Well, first, I wish them to invest in Africa. I would encourage them to look at the extraordinary opportunities that exist in so many different parts of the continent, but also to, of course, be advocates and to be champions of the values that are needed, not just to ensure the dignity and rights of people who live in Africa, but also really the success of their own investment. That, you know, our companies are going to probably find greater likelihood of success in countries, and they know this, where rule of law is protected, where corruption is fought and not encouraged and tolerated.
Most people think that one of the reasons why Americans are losing it out in Africa, and we see other countries like China, Brazil are all getting into Africa, is because they don't scrutinize most of African countries like the U.S. does.
Well, you know, we do ask more of our friends and partners than, say, China does. We ask for high standards of respect for rule of law and fighting corruption, protection of the environment, protection of workers. But we also ask a lot of ourselves. We have high standards for our companies. We want to make sure that when they go to Africa, they contribute to broad-based economic growth. If one of our companies pays a bribe, they're going to go to jail in the United States because we will prosecute them. We expect them to be transparent about the payments that they make to governments all over the world. And I think that most people in Africa, just as most people in Asia and Europe and Latin America, would rather have investment from countries, from companies that hold themselves to those high standards, because those are the companies that are going to transfer not just financial capital to a small elite, but intellectual capital and prosperity to a much broader range of people.
That was Tom Malinowski, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights and Labor. He was speaking to reporter Edward Rema. It is Thursday, August 14, and you are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Peter Clote in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Ahead on our program, Mark Holmes Sports and our listener of the day. The deserts of North Africa might be an unlikely place to search for water, but that's exactly where some of Africa's most surprising underground supplies have been discovered. A recent study concluded that there's 100 times more water beneath the earth in Africa than what is available above ground. That topic and others regarding food security are among the many topics that will be addressed at the African Green Revolution Forum in early September. Irungu Hilton is a senior policy advisor for the African Green Revolution Forum. He says the meeting will look at how the 300 million Africans who do not have access to clean water could benefit from this untapped resource.
What science has discovered over the last year or so is that there are a large number of underground water aquifers in Africa that have as yet not really been tapped. Something like 100 times what's available on the surface of the continent is now available under the continent. What's particularly interesting is that those resources actually can be found in North Africa, areas that are considered to be extremely desertified, short of water sources. Now, as we know, the potential for a continent like Africa is huge, huh? In the sense that something like a third of the continent, or 300 million people, do not have access to clean water, and only 5% of our arable land is currently irrigated. So the potential for this, not just for African agriculture, but even for exporting water, becomes really interesting.
When you say it's in North Africa, what country specifically?
Well, it's not just in North Africa. There's a high concentration in North Africa, but across the entire continent in different belts, there are huge underground water aquifers. Just to give you an example from an area that's very close to me here in Nairobi, Turkana, an area that is really known to be an arid area, has just discovered huge water aquifers that probably could service the entire country, just to give you a sense of the scale. But in terms of North Africa, it's countries like Libya and Morocco that have these large aquifers.
Have any of these aquifers been tapped?
Not sufficiently enough. I mean, what the study showed is that much of this water is completely untapped. The question, of course, now becomes whether we should have a large-scale tapping of these aquifers, or whether we should really be looking at local community-based boreholes to basically tap this to ensure that we do not essentially squander this wonderful resource that we may have discovered. The classic corollary that we need to make is really with the large-scale land grabs or the large-scale land acquisition, if you want to be more polite. But we've seen over the last 5 years, tens of thousands of acres simply handed over to Indian, Middle Eastern and European companies, either to produce food crops for export or to produce biofuels. Many of those hectares that are productive, and in many cases, they will have access to water. So the danger is really we would see a repetition of this scramble for Africa's resources, this time for water.
Is there a specific example of an aquifer that has been tapped that is in use right now, an underground aquifer?
Current findings, are essentially in addition to aquifers that we've known about. And so it's not only the case that they've not been tapped, but I don't have a ratio of what we're currently using in terms of underground water versus what has been found, except just simply to say that the amounts that are untapped are just huge. I mean, 100 times is the figure that they're using.
That was Irungu Hilton, senior policy advisor for the African Green Revolution Forum. He was speaking to Ricky Shryok from Nairobi. It's now time for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here's Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, Peter. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin at the Africa Senior Athletics Championships in Marrakech, Morocco. Tyrone Atkins, Alex Alamin, and Martins Ogiraki clinched a 1-2-3 Nigerian medal podium sweep in men's 110-meter hurdles on Wednesday. South Africans Sunet Fulyun, Shane Rami, and Kotso Mokwena each bagged a gold medal in women's javelin along with men's pole vault and triple jump. Mohamed Hesham Mostafa and Percent Mohamed Herki handed Egypt their first medals of the championships with a gold and silver medal in men's hammer throw and women's high jump, respectively, while Burkina Faso's Martha Koala carried the day in women's heptathlon. Earlier on, Jairus Kipchoge Birech, Jonathan Ndiku, and Ezekiel Kemboi secured a 1-2-3 Kenyan win in 3,000-meter steeplechase as Helen Onsando Obiri won women's 1500 meters, while Nigeria prevailed in men's and women's 4x100-meter relays. Staying in Marrakech, South Africa topped the medal table at the start of the final day of these championships today, Thursday. They have 8 gold, 5 silver, and 2 bronze medals. Nigeria are a close second, and Kenya placed third. Botswana and Burkina Faso share fourth place, as Ethiopia and Ivory Coast are tied in sixth spot. Morocco is eighth, Tunisia 9th, and Egypt 10th. They are followed by Algeria, Eritrea, Ghana, Mauritius, and Zambia, while Cameroon, Republic of Congo, and Namibia share 17th spot with one bronze medal each among 19 countries on the medal table. Turning to football, Uganda's Kampala City Council authorities edged Burundi's Atletico 1-0 as Rwanda's military side APR pipped Djibouti's Telkom 1-0 at the Council of Eastern Central Africa Football Association's Sekafa Kagame Club Championships in Kigali, Rwanda on Wednesday. Today, Thursday, Ethiopia's Adama play South Sudan's Atlabara, Rwanda's police engage Somalia's Banadir, and Rwanda's Rayon Sport tackle Zanzibar's Kikosi Maalum cha Kuangamiza Magendo. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, Peter, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And here is our listener mail for this Thursday morning, August 14.
Yes, you permit me to call on the attention of the President in person of President Goodluck Epelejonaga. That based on what is happening in our society in Nigeria, it's very, very disappointing, disheartening, and unpeaceful. I would like to call on the attention of the President to make sure that he takes care of security issue in our society, because the life and the property of the people are very, very important. Looking at what is happening in Northern Nigeria, it's very, very unpleasant. I call on his attention to please watch out very well to what's happening in the northern area. I'm Suleiman Jamata, calling from Jamata in Lokoja local government area. Thank you, Yuri.
Thank you, listener, for your comment. Please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us a message. Before we leave you, let's take a look one more time at some headlines. A Palestinian official says Hamas has agreed to extend a temporary truce with Israel for 5 days. The official told reporters of the agreement late Wednesday, just as a 72-hour ceasefire between Israel and Hamas expired. Israeli officials declined comment on the extension. Negotiators have been meeting in Cairo in search of a lasting pact between Israel and Hamas to end a month of fighting that has left more than 2,000 people dead. That's it for this Thursday, August 14 edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, managing editor William Eagle, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, I'm Peter Clote in Washington saying have a nice day, Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, the West Africa Ebola epidemic continues to claim lives. More than 1,000 people have died in Liberia, Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Nigeria. Will a new experimental drug make a difference? That's next time, right here on VOA Africa.
VOAAfrica.com.
News, features, music from Africa and around the world. You want it? We have it on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
All day, all night.